This is The Guardian.
Hello, it's Grace Dent here. We have a new season of comfort eating ready for you to devour. I sat down with Hollywood royalty Stanley Tucci, who came to tell me the secret ingredient in his favourite British food, the humble cottage pie.
No American has ever been able to say that.
New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The Labour leadership may win the battle for the yuppie moats in the south. We're going to win the battle for the hearts and minds of the Scottish people.
You have to grow your business, and I have to grow my country.
Do you travel with P&O ferries?
No, I've been boycotting P&O ferries for 2.5 years, and I encourage consumers to do the same.
That's not the government's position. I can tell you they're coming to the summit, and the investment will go ahead.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
So here we are on Monday morning at Westminster, Kieran, once again. But there was some really shocking news over the weekend, which none of us expected, which was the death of Alex Salmond, the former leader of the SNP and ex-First Minister of Scotland, who died suddenly at the age of 69. I mean, I, like many people, had a sort of a ping of a Guardian news alert on my phone and stopped what I was doing because he was such a towering figure in British politics and the driving force, of course, behind the move towards Scottish independence. He first came on my radar way back in, I think it was 1990, when he first became leader of the SNP. And back then, we in Scotland thought of the SNP as being the tartan Tories. And they were, you know, they were suspicious of the European Union. They were pretty wary of devolution. And they kind of weren't particularly keen on the idea of a Scottish Parliament process, which even back then was being talked about. And yet over the years, he dragged them, sometimes reluctantly, I think, when it came to some of the party members, towards the place where they became a really major force in British politics. And he kind of broke the system when in 2011, under his leadership, the SNP won a majority, won a landslide victory in the Holyrood elections. And the whole point of the Holyrood elections was that no party could form a majority the way that the electoral system worked. And yet he broke the system. And off the back of that, of course, the scale of the win, it prompted David Cameron to concede an independence referendum on Scottish independence several years later.
Yeah, I remember that campaign really well. I covered it in my former job. And it's interesting now looking back and reading some of the obituaries of Alex Salmond, because so much of how the SNP operated around that time was just taken for granted. But reading back on some of the history and some of the stuff that you would have covered, you realize that he really had to battle to get the SNP to do that. So this idea of the gradualist approach, where you kind of take your wins and you push the Overton window, as it were, just that little bit further towards your eventual goal of independence. From my reporting, when I was covering that referendum, that was the entire strategy. Everybody bought into that. But he really had to fight for that. And did he get expelled from the party, I think, at one point, because he was pro devolution, whereas other people in the party weren't? They saw that as selling out and they should just push for independence in one fell swoop. So he really did change the way that the SNP operated and the way that it approached the central question of independence. And he also, of course, with Nicola Sturgeon, built this incredible coalition of voters that spread from kind of rural, as you say, the tartan Tories, farming communities. I remember up the East Coast talking to cattle farmers, you know, who you would not have expected at the time to be typical SNP voters, but were completely committed to the independence cause, down to Glaswegian progressives, who were probably more attracted by Sturgeon than Salmond. But that was an astonishing coalition to hold together for so long, because those voters were very, very different.
And yet he was a complicated man. I mean, he ultimately fell out with Nicola Sturgeon, who had been his mentee. And they were incredibly close, you know, between the two of them, both big beasts in Scottish politics and actually on the UK stage as well. He was an incredible orator, a very powerful debater. and he became a very influential figure. But he lost his Westminster seat in 2017. And then there was that nightmarish sequence of events which dominated his life and obviously put enormous strains under him, centering around allegations from within the SNP and the Scottish Government of inappropriate sexual conduct in the earlier years. Now, he was eventually cleared of all those charges, but much of that damage to his reputation had been done, and the provenance of those allegations is still something which is bitterly contested. And some of his allies have said that despite his death, they're going to carry on that fight to clear his name in the public mind.
Yes. And even though some of his allies, you know, have alleged that there is a grand conspiracy to stitch Alex Salmond up, even he himself and his lawyer admitted that a lot of his behaviour was inappropriate. And so I think even if you're going to look at it through the most generous of lenses, you've got to admit that his behaviour, particularly towards women, was pretty horrible at times.
Yeah. And of course, Alex Salmond's death, despite the fact that he had broken off from the SNP and set up his own rival pro-independence party, ALWA, he was such a towering figure in the independence debate that it gives us a moment, I guess, to sort of pause and reflect on what it means for independence going forward. And, you know, the party has had its fair share of woes in recent years, not least with Nicola Sturgeon, her husband, Peter Murrell, the former chief executive of the party, being charged in connection with the embezzlement of funds from the party. And then she obviously stood down herself. They've been through several leaders, Humza Yousaf, and now on to John Swinney, who's seen by many in within the SNP as a safe pair of hands, but doesn't have kind of like the political impact that either Alex Salmond or Nicola Sturgeon herself had. And of course, the general election really was sort of a moment, I think, where many Scottish voters that had backed the SNP previously because they felt that it best gave Scotland a voice on the Westminster stage, decided that at the Westminster elections, at least, that actually having a Labour government would provide them with the opportunities to transform the country, plus also the added benefit, as many Scots saw it, to give the Tories a good kicking and transfer the vote. And we ended up in a situation where the SNP lost dozens of seats and Labour, of course, ended up with more than 50 north of the border, up from just two. A real realignment of Scottish politics. And for many people, a really symbolic moment which seemed to signify that actually the debate over independence has been pushed back by a generation, you know, which Alex Salmond and other leading SNP politicians would obviously lament and try and argue that it's still a very, very current debate. But north of the border, it feels that it's if not gone away for good, that it's certainly been delayed for some time to come.
Yeah, and I think there's two things that have contributed to that. It is obviously the kind of end of an era. Those four people really at the top of the SNP for a long time in Alex Salmond, Nicola Sturgeon, Peter Murrell, John Swinney, only one of them now really still around. You do have a talented new generation of politicians.
Kate Forbes,
Stephen Flynn. But, you know, they don't seem to be quite ready to step up yet. But the other thing I think that's happened is more structural, which is the EU referendum. And I went up to Edinburgh pretty much the day, I think, after the Brexit vote, expecting to find a lot of those wavering voters from the first referendum who decided in the end to vote no, now thinking, oh, you know what, we need independence because we need to get back into the EU. And, you know, we've been stuffed here by a Westminster system that we're not fully bought into. But what I found instead was people saying, we really have had enough of constitutional change. Mm-hmm. And I think that feeling of there has been enough turbulence, there's been enough constitutional change, especially in the intervening years with everything that's happened with Brexit, just seems to have embedded itself in the mind of a lot of Scottish voters who think, you know, no more of this, not for now.
And they want to focus on things that are much more directly impactful on their day-to-day lives, the state of the NHS, the state of the transport system, right, state of the economy even, rather than something which for many people feels sometimes quite far away.
Yeah.
I think probably now likely to be even further. But moving on, Kieran, Labour is once again at pains to show that they're the party of business, and they've invited scores of global investors and businesses today to the Guildhall in London for their first international investment summit. Now, it probably hasn't quite got off to the start that they wanted with a row over the weekend involving P&O Ferries, which we can come to in a moment. But Starmer's made a big speech this morning, hasn't he, saying, amongst other things, that they've got to look at regulation where it's needlessly holding back investment to take our country forward. Now, you wrote about this for The Guardian this morning, didn't you?
I did. But before I tell you what I wrote about, I'm going to give you a quote.
Oh, no. Go back to these again. We're back to these.
I found one. All right. Tell me who said this.
Okay.
We have trawled through thousands of pieces of regulation, from the serious to the ridiculous, and we'll be scrapping or amending over 3,000 regulations, saving businesses well over £850 million every single year. That's £500,000, which will be saved for businesses every single day of the year.
Now, the thing is about that quote is it could literally be any leading politician in recent times. It could have been Tony Blair back in the day, but it also, and probably more likely, is somebody who was more recent. So on the Conservative side, maybe David Cameron, or even maybe you're teasing us with a post-Brexit politician, because, of course, we've had repeated promises of bonfires of regulations from the likes of Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Kemi Badenoch et al. And we've never actually entirely seen them. Certainly, when it comes to business regulation. So, have I got one of them right?
Yeah, one of them. It's in there somewhere. Do you want to make a decision?
Okay, I think it's going to be Boris Johnson.
Okay, it was David Cameron.
Oh, right. Okay.
That was his famous bonfire of the regulation speech, where he promised to scrap thousands of business regulations, but particularly safety regulations. Mm. And of course, you're right that that hasn't necessarily freed up the economy in the way that was promised. But I think those moves did have an impact. And in fact, they've been directly blamed for what happened with Grenfell. You know, those building safety changes that meant that the cladding could go up in the way that it did on Grenfell Tower can be directly traced back to that system of, do you remember David Cameron had this one in, two out system?
Yeah,
so for every new regulation you wanted to bring in, you had to get rid of two. Mm. And many people were warning the government that, you know, you needed to do something about this cladding. And Eric Pickles, who was in charge of the local government department at the time, was saying, sorry, we've got this one in, two out system. We just can't put in new regulations.
But what's really interesting is that we don't yet know exactly what these regulations that Labour are planning to cut are going to be. But what we do know is that they're business regulations rather than across the board. So they are obviously very conscious of the dangers of slashing regulation in areas like health and safety, precisely because of, you know, everything you said about Grenfell. But there are many other examples as well. So they're talking about business regulation here.
Yes, they say they're not talking about safety regulation. They're talking about business red tape. I don't know yet whether this is any more than rhetoric. I asked Downing Street yesterday, can you give me an example of one piece of regulation that you might want to get rid of as part of this? And they were not able to give me a single thing. So we don't know whether these are just empty words. Obviously, they're doing these planning reforms. Now, that is an example of getting rid of regulations to help growth. So maybe that's what they're talking about. They insist that there is more to it than that. There's also this intriguing suggestion in what Keir Starmer said today, where he started talking about some of the UK's main regulators themselves, and particularly talking about the Competition and Markets Authority and having the CMA focus more on growth. And apparently there was a move under the last government to change the remit of the CMA to have it focus more on growth, but it never actually got enacted. So I think that that's the kind of thing Labour's talking about doing now. The interesting thing to put that in a global context is in the US, where Rachel Reeves gets a lot of her economic inspiration from, they're kind of doing the opposite, actually. So the competitions regulator over there, the Federal Trade Commission, is being much stricter now on anti-competitive behavior and monopolistic practices. And it's seeking to define those in a way that's really unusual in America, and basically as a way to go after companies like Google and Microsoft and the big tech companies. So they're seeking to define competition law in this completely new, completely radical way so that they can go after some of these companies they believe are monopolies. Over here, we've got the complete opposite, because we're told that, no, we want the CMA to push for growth. And by the way, who's one of the most prominent companies at this investment today? It's Google. Mm-hmm. So there's all this talk about welcoming the tech sector in and, you know, making a big push for AI. It's just an interesting point of diversion for me between the Biden administration and Keir Starmer's government over
and
here.
And presumably one that this government sees as an opportunity. But as well as this deregulatory drive, which the unions are kind of a bit cautious about, we've obviously heard from them this morning suggesting that the government set out its workers' rights legislation at the end of last week. And what whereas the government always talks about it being pro-business and pro-worker. I think the unions are sitting there going, hey, hang on a sec here, guys, remember the pro-worker bit here. Because Starmer's been coming out this morning and saying all sorts of things about, you know, telling business not to worry about the legislation, that it's not going to impact on their ability to invest and to grow. But as well as all of that, we've got the government setting out a green paper, which is detailing the government's industrial strategy, which officials have said is going to focus on 8 growth-driving sectors as well. Now, this is actually quite a big deal, Kieran, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big deal. I mean, not least because the previous government didn't like to talk about industrial strategy at all. And actually, you know, this is part of Keir Starmer's worldview. He is much more statist, I think, than previous Conservative prime ministers have been. And he's willing to say, you know, these are the sectors that we're interested in, whether it is AI, whether it is, you know, green technology. This government is willing to put its hand on the scales, as the phrase goes. We'll be looking at that in detail this morning. I see that the actual publication of the industrial strategy was slightly hampered by the fact that the link didn't work. So hopefully that'll be back online this afternoon and we can look at it
properly.
I know, right? Well, talking about seamless announcements, we've also had an absolutely, well, maybe not dreadful, but certainly turbulent run-up to this investment summit. And this, again, demonstrates this dichotomy that the government has between being, oh, we're 100% pro-growth, but also 100% you know, pro-worker and 100% lots of other things, because we've had this extraordinary row where Louise Hague, the Transport Secretary, last week described P&O Ferries as a rogue operator in a press statement, and then followed up with an interview where she said she would be boycotting or has been boycotting the company and has encouraged her officials not to have any dealings with them. That in itself is not particularly surprising, given that was Labour's position in opposition. P&O sacked 800 workers in 2022 without any notice and then replaced them with agency workers on lower salaries. And that is exactly the kind of practice that Labour's workers' rights package is supposed to stop. The problem being that P&O's parent company, the Dubai-owned DP World, was due to go to this investment summit and announce a £1 billion investment at it. There were reports on Friday that DP World got very cross about Louise Hague's comments and was now not coming to the summit and might put its investment on pause. From what I'm told by sources in the Middle East, privately, the company was saying, actually, no, it's fine. We're still going to go ahead with this.
And they're here, right?
And they're here. And they're making their announcement. But the person who's really suffered through this is the Transport Secretary herself, who is kind of reprimanded in public by Downing Street. By Keir Starmer. And Jonathan Reynolds, the Business Secretary, was doing the broadcast rounds this weekend saying she doesn't represent the government view.
So I think this is really interesting because, as you say, this has been the government's position for a long time, in opposition as well. And yes, her words just before the summit were maybe less than diplomatic in terms of timing. But she was only saying what a lot of people really believe. And I think it's sort of an insight into the way the government is thinking. Perhaps they're more sort of sensitive about it right now because of this investment summit. But I think they can afford to be honest about, you know, some of the practices of these big, often multinational companies. You know, this is the pro-worker bit, right? And I think they would find that there's a lot of public support for, you know, P&O workers or workers who are employed by companies that adopt practices like these. And, you know, maybe they just need to be a bit bolder and be able to say, look, you know, we can both want the investment of this company, but frankly, their behaviour is not good enough. And I don't think it would do them as much harm as they think it would. So many people out there beyond Westminster think that there's a real problem with capitalism as it exists anyway, and actually wouldn't mind the government having a pot shot with some of the biggest offenders.
Yeah, I don't think it was public opinion they were concerned about. They just didn't want the investment summit blowing up. But they knew that that's all we would cover. Even if probably they thought, well, look, DP World's eventually going to announce this investment because it depends on more than just warm words from the UK. What they didn't want is 48 hours of coverage they were hoping to get on how the government's pro-growth being all about this one piece of cancelled investment. So I suspect that's why they perhaps slightly overreacted. The other thing I'd say is that Louise Hague didn't know DP World was going to the summit. She didn't know about that planned investment. So I think people close to her say she was pretty upset by the whole row, given that she'd not been told anything in advance. Yeah. And our colleague Toby Helm at The Observer had a very good piece this weekend where he revealed that Keir Starmer had to call Hague on Saturday, I think, just to reassure her and to say, look, I still have complete confidence in you. And I'm sorry that the way that this has all played out in public.
This is the new number 10 operation, of course, things going very smoothly so far. But also, we're just a couple of weeks away from Labour's first budget. And that was one of the other questions which was bubbling away ahead of the investment summit, which is why they were holding it this side of the budget, yeah. when at the budget we're expecting some taxes on wealth and business to be announced. Now, Peter Kyle, the science secretary, was on the radio this morning suggesting that this isn't actually going to be a problem for the government. And the government's line is that what the single biggest thing that they get told by business that they want is stability, economic stability. Then actually, individual taxes going up or down won't necessarily have a massive impact on whether they decide to invest or not. That, of course, is not what business says.
No.
When you speak to them, because taxes are obviously, and planning for them, preparing for them, are part of the whole sort of the bigger, the broader picture when it comes to economic stability. But the government today, if you look at the agenda of this investment summit, there's various plenaries where they're specifically going to be selling Britain, really, as a stable place to invest. And it is true that if you step back and look at the global picture, huge political turbulence in the States in the run-up to the US election and uncertainty about what follows after that, including on sort of, you know, things like, or particularly on trade and whether there's going to be a sort of a more aggressive approach by the US, depending on who wins the election. And then here, closer to home, you look over to Europe and there's also political instability in some of our, you know, greatest allies, but also greatest rivals when it comes to investment. Think places like Germany and France, that Britain thinks it can capitalise on after a very turbulent period under the Conservatives, to be able to turn around and say, look, what you see is what you get. We've said that what we're going to do, we're going to prioritise growth, we're going to deregulate when it comes to business, we're going to create an environment that is supported and supportive of business. Please come here. That they think that actually they can ride through the next couple of weeks and that will be an attractive proposition. And then, of course, the other thing that we should say about the budget very quickly is that we've been reporting over the last couple of weeks that the government is planning to slightly tweak the way that the fiscal rules, the debt rule in particular, is calculated to free up billions of pounds for investment. And I did an interview marking the 100 days of this government with Keir Starmer over the weekend, or we published it over the weekend. And he said two things which I thought were interesting. One was that they do absolutely understand the importance of capital investment, public sector investment, to match the private sector investment in our infrastructure to drive growth, his number one aim. And the second thing is about keeping his eye on the horizon and not being buffeted by what he described as sidewinds, which he regards, and some in Number 10 regard, these rows over Number 10 infighting, over donations, over presumably Lou Hague and what she said about P&O. They want to keep their eyes on the prize. Now, I hear my doots, as we say north of the border, about whether they will be able to do that and not be buffeted by those sidewinds. And they need to be careful not to sort of act dismissive or aloof about them. But it says quite a lot about Starmer, I think, that he is trying, after many years where we've had this sort of like short-termism in British politics, where he's trying to inject a bit more long-term thinking. And that presumably will be attractive to business.
Yes, I think so. But the thing that I would say that makes the DP World row quite important is not necessarily the personnel, but it is the problem that has been inherent in Keir Starmer's leadership from the beginning, which is he doesn't like making choices, actually. He doesn't come down on one side of the fence or the other very quickly. And that leaves the rest of his cabinet in limbo. So what is the line on P&O Ferries? Is it a rogue operator like they used to say, or is it actually a company that we want investing in our ports infrastructure? You know, because the Prime Minister hasn't made that decision and set the tone clearly enough, that then leaves all these other individual problems to trip them up along the way. And that's why I think it is more of a problem than people in Number 10 seem to think. You know, I don't think it's necessarily just a sidewind. I think it's symptomatic of a broader problem, which is they are constantly trying to be everything to everyone. And you can't do it, especially not in government. You have to make choices.
Yeah, politics is tough choices, as Tony Blair once said. And then, of course, the other thing which always comes up with business is our relationship with the European Union. And there are plenty of businesses that would wish that we had never left, but accept that we are where we are. And they're very keen to hear from this government what they're going to do about having a closer trading relationship. Now, Keir Starmer has repeated ad nauseum that there's no way we're going back into the single market and no way we're going back into the customs union for the foreseeable future, whatever may or may not happen in future. And that is because, of course, they regard them as being politically toxic issues. We've had the Brexit wars at, you know, two or three of the last elections. Brexit was barely an issue at this election and they want to keep it that way. But at the same time, if growth is their single biggest ambition, then the single best way of doing that is to have closer trading relationships with the EU.
There we go. There's another choice that they're going to have to make, right? And there's one coming up very quickly, which is on the youth mobility scheme. So Yes, Keir Starmer wants to pursue closer relations with the EU, but diplomatic leaders in Brussels have made it clear that if he wants to do that on things like defence or agricultural products, he needs to sign up, or at least show willingness to sign up to some form of youth mobility scheme. Now, Downing Street will know that there are parts of Fleet Street that are ready to absolutely go after them if they show any sign of wanting to get involved in a youth mobility scheme. There are papers that will call that a return to free movement straight away. That he's going to need to decide, do I ride that? Do I accept that? Do I take that hit? And do I pursue closer relations with the EU anyway? Or is that just too much of a threat to my political programme and I'm going to have to back away from this fight?
More tough political choices ahead for Keir Starmer. But that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Ian Sample from Science Weekly here. From the climate crisis to the next pandemic, we're committed to bringing you the most up-to-date science and environment stories. And you can trust in our journalism because we don't have billionaire owners or shareholders setting the agenda. But that does mean we rely on you, our listeners, to help fund our podcasts. If this is something you feel you could do, please click on the support link in the episode description. Thank you.
This is The Guardian.
Hello, it's Grace Dent here. We have a new season of comfort eating ready for you to devour. I sat down with Hollywood royalty Stanley Tucci, who came to tell me the secret ingredient in his favourite British food, the humble cottage pie.
No American has ever been able to say that.
New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.